make them more effective and loving. And one of the things that you talk about is an open, spacious heart. And I'm thinking about it in the context of homelessness. I know that that's a big leap, but you know, we're all aware of those people who are unhoused, and we drive around, we see them there with their shopping carts and all of their belongings with them as they cart them around. But you use a phrase that really popped for me. You talk about our inner homelessness. And I would really love for you to describe what you feel that is and how it lands for us in our hearts.
Well, thank you. And first, to be very, very clear, I'm not trying to equate in any way, shape, or form the consequences of inner homelessness with the consequences of outer unhousedness or outer homelessness, to be crystal clear about that. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes said that the root of all sickness is homesickness. The root of all sickness is homesickness. And that's a very deep and profound kind of proverb. What does that mean? Our home base, biologically, as evolved, you know, primates, hominids, Stone Age humans, modern humans, our home base, and that of other complicated animals, is a fairly peaceful, contented, and depending on the species, warm-hearted place. That's our home base. That's Mother Nature's blueprint for maximum effectiveness in the world, resilience, coping, positive relationships, passing on genes that pass on genes. That's her longevity, health, and all the rest of that. The problem is we get driven from that home base routinely by chronic stressors. Most episodes of stress in the wild end quickly, one way or another, for other species. But for human
either
beings,
we're killed by the tiger.
Yeah, or we get away.
Or we get away. Right.
As Robert Sapolsky, extraordinary professor, Stanford, wrote in his book, that's why zebras don't get ulcers. Humans get ulcers because we're exposed to chronic, often mild, but still chronic stressors that push us away from the green zone of our home into the red zone continuously. And people can become increasingly alienated from themselves, from their core of being. That's why it's so important, as I talk about in the book and how to do it, to come home multiple times a day for half a breath or two or three breaths in a row, or have some kind of practice while walking the dog, making a meal, offering a prayer, saying grace, looking back on your day just before sleep, and just kind of slowing down and appreciating what was good in it amidst all the crazy. We need to come home multiple times a day to know what it's like to be at home inside ourselves. And then increasingly, you are at home inside yourself wherever you go, you know, with practice over time. Or if you get driven from your home for a few minutes, something happens, someone is really offensive with you, or you see something that's just appalling, or your trauma is triggered from your childhood, okay, you might leave that centered place from home for a few minutes, a few hours at the most, but you can find your way back really quickly, the more practice that you have with this homecoming. And this is completely fundamental.
So I'm thinking, Rick, this is really a bodily thing. I mean, it's an inner refuge, but it's where I imagine it when you're talking about it just now is, okay, taking that deep breath and coming back into an awareness of my own physical being and the chair I'm sitting on and just feeling like, oh, in this moment, I'm okay right now, right here, right now. I'm
yes,
okay.
Yes, and there's a really important point here, which is that sometimes we're not really okay. So there's nothing about this that's positive thinking, looking
right
at the world through. If anything, the harder your life, the more it sucks, the more important it is to build up the strengths inside that you and I are talking about, right? So what is that sense of home? It's a sense of your field of awareness. It's a sense of a kind of an innermost core of being that at bottom is good, is loving, is wise. It is to feel in the present that you are safe enough, satisfied enough, and connected enough, which is our three major needs, safety, satisfaction, and connection, so that authentically, even if it's not perfect around you, in the core of your being, you're basically all right now, like you said. Also, you can feel content. There's an enoughness in the present, on the basis of which you could still aspire. You could still dream big dreams, dare greatly, as Brené Brown puts it, on the basis of an underlying sense of contentment. This is the heart of the wisdom teachings of so many traditions, including my own root tradition, early Buddhism. And then love. You feel connected enough in the moment. Your heart's open, right? It might be nice to have more people like you, more people love you. You want to get more, I don't know, 5-star ratings on Amazon for your book or something like that. But there's an enoughness about it, you know, an enoughness. So, you know, that's what I mean by home base. It's not airy fairy. It's not new age. It's not metaphysical. You're right. There's an embodied sense of being at home. But you can just hear my words as I speak here. Both of us are getting in touch with this homecoming. Exactly. I can feel it in myself. I can see it in you. Maybe people can hear it as we talk. We know what it's like. And it's important to protect your home. It's important to protect your home and to be careful about the world jostling you out of it, other people bullying you, pushing you around. No. You know, you may, you know, you don't get my home. You know, I live in my home. It's my home. You know, I'm not going to allow you to drive me away from it or to possess it yourself.
Rick, I'm going to take a leap here because there's a story that you tell, and I don't know if I can marry this story with what you just said about our home, but somehow I feel it's related. And you tell a story about doing some diving at some point in the ocean, and you were going into a kelp forest. And you got tangled up in that. How you got out of that is somehow coming home to yourself.
So I nearly drowned. I was off the coast of California, trapped in kelp. I was about 16. And in an experience that was quite extraordinary, and it's kind of sacred for me, after panicking. So basically, I completely panicked. Thrashed. I was drowning. I was going to die. And then after some period of panicking, there was a shift of consciousness and a completely calm, peaceful, untroubled kind of awareness was present. And on the basis of it, with my mask around my neck, my snorkel out of my mouth, I had lost a fin from panicking and thrashing, I very calmly began to pluck the ropes of kelp off my body so I could gradually work my way upward through them rather than it being like one of those Chinese finger traps where you, the more you pull, the tighter it gets. And then I cleared the kelp, went up to the surface, and then normal consciousness returned. But many of us also have a sense, have had experiences that at the base of our home, at the foundation of it, the ground of it, does move into something that's transcendental, that's unconditioned, perhaps, as the Buddha taught, and perhaps with other attributes of awareness and love.
And I'm thinking in that case, you became in this panic, in this terrible situation. It was terrible. I mean, you could drown. I mean, you were close to drowning. And in that way, when you went into that other consciousness, and I'd say it's a personal refuge of consciousness, you became effective.
That's correct.
So we're more effective when we're not thrashing around against it all, coming home to ourselves, and then out of that place, we can be more effective.
Yes, and exactly. You got it, Justine, which is you, because you always do. We surrender. We have to surrender to what is necessary. And sometimes it's poignant. You start to realize that given your values and given the realities of life, it's necessary to get out of a certain job or a certain relationship or it's necessary to start working with different people, perhaps in some enterprise you're engaged with, or it's necessary to stop drinking. You can't drink moderately, so you can't drink at all. It's just necessary. Or it's necessary to do the hard thing and admit fault with another person. But there's a kind of surrender there. So what happened for me in the kelp is that I surrendered to what was necessary. And that surrender has a kind of power of its own. You start to feel like in this relationship, for example, not with the drama of nearly drowning, but in the ordinary rough and tumble of life, you know, we need to tell the truth here. We need to be more real with each other. We need to be brave enough to be authentic, like you were saying in the very beginning. It's necessary. And then there's something really peaceful when you surrender to what's necessary. It has a power all of its own. You're not second-guessing yourself anymore. You're not going back and forth like Gollum, you know. You give up. You give over to what is actually necessary for the good, including of yourself.
Right. Even when it's difficult, let's say, and you mentioned it earlier, that like you're having a difficult relationship and maybe it comes time to, well, number one, to tell the truth.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of truth-telling that you advocate that's with often both authenticity and kindness. So we're not blaming people, or we're approaching it differently. Is that what you're helping us to see?
Oh, yeah. It's funny, as you know, the book has structured in 6 parts, and part, I think, 5 is the longest by far. And I think it's something like Speak Wisely, because there's a lot of how-to about that. So I'm drawing on lots of good research and practices and teachings of others, including things like nonviolent communication from Marshall Rosenberg, bless his memory. But the how-to is really useful to know how-to. Like, for example, how to watch your tone. One of the things I've really learned is the impact of tone. What you're saying could well be true, and it's your right to say it. But when you start adding that topspin of tone, you know, your eyes start to roll, or you start getting exasperated, or like, I can't believe I'm having to tell you this for the third freaking time. You know, that's what people react to.
Go.
And, you know, there's a place for communicating anger, but watch your tone.
Well, I want to go more into this. We can't leave this subject hanging here, but I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Dr. Rick Hansen, and he's the author of Making Great Relationships. And I'm Justine Willis-Toms, and you're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Rick Hansen, and we're talking about many, many subjects. But right now, this subject that we're really starting to delve into is watch your words. And one of the things that you bring up in the book, and you do it several times, and I think it's such wise advice, and this has to do with watching our words and being empathetic. And that's looking at the faces, observing the faces of the people with which we're speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much that can be gleaned from that. And we kind of talk beyond it and we don't even notice each other. So let's talk about that.
Oh, so sweet. First, when I say watch your words or speak wisely, it's not about tone policing, as they say. And it's not about some kind of suppressing of yourself or there's some magic formula way to say it. Just obviously recognizing that we can be more or less skillful with our speech. And very often the words we use and how we say them with our tone has a lot of impact. This also includes how we talk with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
How do you talk with yourself in a way that has wisdom in it and benevolence woven together? Can you speak to yourself in a way that's wise and caring and kind? Mm-hmm. Very important. So all that said about faces, yeah, it's so interesting how we just blow right by each other routinely. And we don't slow it down for that second to track micro expressions around the eyes. We have the most expressive eyes of any species on the planet.
Wow.
Also look at micro expressions around the mouth. Very expressive. You can get a lot of information from other people, especially if you slow down and kind of receive them, right? Rather than jumping to a conclusion. And I find that this is really helpful because it gives you information. You're reserving your rights. Doesn't mean you're agreeing. It also helps you deal with your anger. Because if you're getting mad at somebody, but if you slow it down to have a feeling for them as a being, a thou, that you disagree with, that you oppose, that you're mad at, okay. But as you have a sense of them as a thou, you're much more likely to be reasonable and to not do something that's going to get you in trouble later or enable them to avoid the substance of what you're saying because they're fixating on how you said it, which, gosh, sometimes does happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
They use how you said it to avoid dealing with what you said. So this way, if you offer what you're saying in a cleaner, clearer kind of way, then they just have to deal with it. And you can keep coming back to it and not get sidetracked
right by
their objections to how you said it.
Well, I'm thinking, too, going back to compassion and also empathy, if we're truly present, then we can start to recognize the common humanity.
Yeah.
Somehow, even looking at their face, they've got a face, I've got a face, they've got eyes, I've got eyes. You know, we both want to be out of pain and we both want to be feeling safe and loved. So if we go there, whatever the words that are said are not so triggering.
Oh, completely true, because we feel more related. You know, you're kind of making me bring up this Global Compassion Coalition that I founded with colleagues around the world, which now is just really cooking, and people can check it out at globalcompassioncoalition.org or just do a search on it. You'll find it. The basic idea there is that on the one hand, if you read the newspaper headlines, it looks like humanity is in deep trouble. And obviously, we are in certain regards. There are nuclear weapons. There is global warming. There are tragedies every day that 10,000 children die a day of hunger-related causes. The women are, and girls are put down and terrible things happen routinely. Many, many problems. I'm all for that. How are we going to solve them? In our biological history, as Homo sapiens, people like you and me, Justine, have walked the earth for 300,000 years. That's a long time. We evolved biologically a unique strategy of caring and sharing compassion and justice as the basis for our social life, the basis for our politics inside the bands. That's unique among hundreds of other primate species to live on the basis of compassion and justice. Inside of which people squabbled, they're irritated. You know, two people might want the same partner, they had to work it out. Okay, fine. The good of the many was the focus of the band. But then with agriculture and surpluses and elites and wealth and power, it's been Game of Thrones for 10,000 years. And what are we going to do to change it? We have to scale up to 8 billion people what worked for 97% of the time our ancestors have walked this earth. at the level of our individual tribes. How to do that is we need new frames. And so the purpose of our coalition is to convene a new kind of global commons, is to build a new kind of global commons in which millions of people and organizations worldwide who differ from each other in lots of ways can come together around one thing, which is that people matter. Suffering matters. And if we care about suffering, we must change its systemic causes once and for all. And so that's the fundamental purpose. People, it's free. It's wonderful. Come join us.
Hey, I've joined and New Dimensions joins. And I just encourage everybody, because as you say, this is the commons. We're looking for that place where we all agree. You know, that's what you're going down to, that bedrock of what humanity, as you said, for 10,000 years, we kind of lived in this other way. But for 290,000 years, we've lived in this coalition of cooperation and compassion. Yeah. And it's worked.
That's our home base. Speaking of home base, that's our home base. And, you know, there's the line like, you know, two fish are swimming past each other. One fish says to the other one, "Hey, how's the water?" And the other one pauses and goes, "What's water?" Right? It's the water we swim in. We think it's normal. It's not normal. It's not normal for eight men right now, today, to hold as much wealth as 4 billion people. That's not normal. That's crazy cakes, right? It's not normal that 80% of the people in the world live under the thumb, if not the boot, of an authoritarian system. Right? Only 6% of the world lives in a high-functioning democracy, which does not include the 340 or so million Americans in our own country right now. Right?
Right.
We need to return to our home of compassion and justice. The two going together. And we need to find ways to make that happen. And the only way we're going to make it happen is by large coalitions forming. Right? I don't know about you. In the pro-social world, the nonprofit world, the do-gooder world, it's really interesting. On the one hand, business people, aggressive business people, compete at the marketplace level, but they cooperate at the political level. They put their money in a single bucket. In the last 15 years in America, the oil and gas industry has spent $2 billion to block climate change legislation. $2 billion. And you know what? They got what they paid for, right? If we were to compete with those kind of forces, we got to scale up. But the problem is most nonprofits, most pro-social organizations are the opposite. They're friendly at the marketplace level. They're nice to each other. They almost never put their money in a single bucket at the scale that's big enough to actually drive systemic change. And the examples of systemic change that we can look at, civil rights, women's rights, environmentalism, gay rights, and some others, while still we have a long way to go. Okay. But in those examples, what happened? What made it work? Coalitions formed. People of very diverse interests and types, whatever, joined together under a single common cause and put their resources or money in a single bucket to make things be better. And that's what we need to do in the world today. So what we're doing in the Global Compassion Coalition is creating frameworks in which that can happen.
You're creating a way for people to work together.
Yes.
Where we resource one another and we really come together to spark that shift in consciousness that brings us home again to who we really are. And we really are kind, loving people who care about each other. That's the truth, even though the media and the internet and stuff will just keep feeding us with these algorithms of things that would tell us otherwise. So this coalition, this Global Compassion Coalition, is really coming together. I'm very excited about it, Rick, is coming together with wonderful, powerful, earth-shaking movers and people that are agreeing that we can do this differently, and we must go back to our roots.
Mm-hmm. That's right, to create a frame. How do you create a frame?
Yeah.
With high tech, the internet, right? How do you create a frame in which people can come together at a scale that's effective for the common good?
Exactly.
Many, many people are doing great stuff. We're not trying to replace anybody. We're just trying to create a frame, taking a page out of our ancestors' book, in which the many can come together for the greater good, rather than what's been true for the last 10,000 years, is that the few have run things for their own sake, but not for the greater good of everybody.
So it's the global village, really, truly.
Yeah.
The global village. So, Rick, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And I want to just remind people, if you want to know about his personal work, Rick Hansen, S-O-N, rickhansen.net, or go to globalcompassioncoalition.org. Or you can get to both of these through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. Thank you so much for being with us. This is program number 3785.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rajiv Bharti, author of Dying to Wake Up. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about my near-death experience under the book Dying to Wake Up.